God's not dead, he's merely hiding. You can see him in the morning when the sun is rising. Greed's not good and God's not dead. Don't care what Nietzsche or Ayn Rand said. The blood of every man is red, and I'm not going to war. They justify all the things they do with convoluted logic and waves still pound upon the sand and will when they're gone. God's not dead, he's merely hiding. You can see him in the morning when the sun is rising. You can build a paradise or wall yourself into a tomb or kick against the holy wolf.
It is time for a weekly visit from our favorite social, political, and metaphysical commentator, Les Visible. He writes several blogs right around the globe that express his reality as it is seen from beyond that smoky mirror of spin and deception, with a style and candor that cuts deep, separating, as it were, the bone from the marrow. And here at Feet to Fire, we experience the audio edition with the powerful poetic delivery of his written message, with a style that you will love or hate, depending upon your desire to be alive and awaken to the light of truth, or remain asleep in the darkness of delusion. Let us take a trip across the pond to somewhere in Europe, and this week's comments from Les Visible.
And welcome to the Saucer Pod this evening, here in the latter days of the fall of the Empire. George Soros, David Rockefeller, and the whole Rothschild clan are sucking down pina coladas made out of fresh-squeezed children and 90-proof human blood. They think the dominoes will fall their way. After all, they stacked the dominoes to begin with. I'm guessing there's a reason for the popularization of vampire culture, goth lifestyles, and all those Twilight series movies, since the wheels of economy, politics, and religion are driven by vampires. Stands to reason they should be celebrated in contemporary culture. Well, we could talk about these terrible excuses for a human being. God knows enough isn't being said about them, other than the public smooch fest being trotted out by the Israeli-owned media every day, which makes heroes out of people who are stone-cold psychopaths. In these times, the very worst of us are brought into states of great prominence and power for the purpose of demonstration. It looks one way to them and one way to us and another way entirely to the cosmos. These creatures were doomed before they were born and only came into this life for the purpose of judgment. Some who arrive here are slotted for general improvements and many possibilities that may or may not be realized. The monsters, though, there's not much likelihood that they will be anything more than monsters at the end of their term, except for possibly even greater monsters. Karma is like that. There are things you can do about it, but the tendency for you to want to do something about it might be outweighed by the general inertia and lethargy of your resistance to change. There's a precision to things that we only see through a glass darkly. In times of darkness, it is a real struggle to see clearly. We need more light, and we need the good offices of a guide. There are other times, times far back in unrecorded memory, where it was easier to see. But these are the darkest of times, and few can see with any clarity. We have to rely on another pair of eyes. We have to rely on a greater heart and mind than our own. In former times, it was possible to follow some number of paths with the expectation of success. In these times, the only safe bet is bhakti, and throwing yourself on the mercy and support of the divine. Many of you may wonder why you are being ground down so relentlessly and often seem to be hemmed in on all sides by imponderables that don't make any sense. See, the rational part of my mind tells me this can't be happening. There's no way that the awful things we see coming about every day can actually be happening. There's no way that all of our leaders can be so corrupt, mercenary, and indifferent to the lives and needs of others. None of it makes sense. Let's consider that. First of all, how can the rational side of us be aware of that which lies beyond reason and expect a rational movement of people and events in an irrational age? Both reason and rationale have left the building. Trying to make sense out of the world is a mug's game. It's the same as trying to make sense out of the worlds that lie beyond the senses. You can't expect one set of tools that operate in one environment to operate with the same functionality and efficiency in an entirely different wavelength of existence. That's why there is another sense that is seated above each physical sense, and these can be activated through an intensification of spiritual fervor. All sorts of benefits come about through a sustained application of spiritual disciplines. There are some segment of the people that follow what goes on around here and at the blogs who think, I'm at least half mad and unstable to boot. That's as it should be. I like that projection, that persona. It keeps the fundies and straight arrows out of my orbit. The last thing I want is for those expecting a predictable routine to expect it from me. I don't do predictable, and neither does the universe when it comes to human affairs. Sure, the planets move in their orbits, just like the ones we're on. Or the one we're on, rather. The seasons come and go, and you could say there's an order and routine to human lives, but things come out of the blue all the time. We can seldom predict their occurrence. We have to adapt all the time to the unexpected, and the way we do this is the measure of our maturity. It has been said of old that there is a power that moves invisibly through nature and through human affairs. It stands to reason, there's that word again, that one's number one priority should be to make positive contact with this force. This can only be achieved through surrender and the prevailing awareness that you will never comprehend it. Look at the character and behavior of the very wise. They are crowned with humility and wreathed in an unseen beauty that cannot be directly seen but only felt. They have become a habitation of the divine. This is the single important objective in life. There is no other ambition or goal that has any meaning whatsoever. All other dreams are fool's gold, a caravan of Fata Morganas that march into nowhere across endless trackless sands, the futile dreams of mortality. They come and go like the generations that appear in the wind of a continuous bellows that drives them into manifestation, only to claim them again. They come and they go. They accrue fortunes. They command armies. They burn in the cities of desire until there is nothing left but emptiness, and the one thing that never leaves them is an unconsolable longing, which cannot be satiated by anything in this world, and yet it seldom dawns on them. For some reason, it seldom dawns on them. I think some part of it has to do with self-will and the presumption that there is something we can do personally about any of it. The world teaches us to rely on our own power. This is how the world enslaves us. Personal power is a myth, but the illusion of it is real, if that makes any kind of sense. It's a given that things held in fixed forms will harden over time. This is what happens to our established beliefs, our regular routines and rituals. This is the entropy pool of fundamentalism. You can't get anywhere near the grace and heart of the divine by the performance of dogma and cant. You don't get there by pointless and pretentious walks around the metal statues of departed saints. I went to the Ramana Maharshi Ashram in Tiruvannamalai in India, and as soon as I walked into the place, I felt like something was off. There was this leaden and serious vibe that swallowed whatever good feeling I had carried in there with me. I didn't want to say anything to the fellow I went in there with because he's one of those people that takes himself very seriously. I had plenty of time to observe that while I was there. Later, an actual friend of mine told me that the Jesuits had taken over control of the ashram some time ago. There's this big central room where well-to-do Westerners go to walk around the Ramana statue, which is seated on a dais. They raise a foot, it hovers in the air, and then they step it forward. This ridiculous ritualistic puffery is repeated over and over. It's not so odd if you happen to be walking behind them. One feels, one who sees this sort of thing for what it is, feels a near overpowering need to cry out and say something that certainly won't be appreciated in such solemn and dead surroundings. I could not wait to get out of there. Much of my experience in India was like this. On all sides, up and down the many crowded streets, were people with nothing, begging from the passersby. There were the prosperous and well-to-do. There were those in between. Everywhere you looked, you also saw prosperous Westerners, as indifferent to the poverty as are the prosperous Indians, who see everything as being your karma, although generally they take care of each other better than the Westerners do. And while I was there, I did my best to relate to the Indian people. I would take my rickshaw drivers out to lunch and for drinks now and again. One of them told me that in the 15 years he'd been driving, that no Westerner had ever been that good to him before. He was weeping when he said it. I was astounded to hear this. All through my stay there, I could hear the divine speaking in my head, saying many things, but most of the time saying, "Don't be cheap with others, and I won't be cheap with you." This self-important fellow that I mentioned, and whom I would often visit for conversation, and for whom I did a lot of editing work on his books, suddenly developed an attitude toward me. There had been no sign of it during the previous weeks, during which I'd been assisting him. I could sense, though, as I always do, that there was a change in his manner toward me. I asked him what was wrong. Did he have a problem with me? He said, "No, why would I have a problem with you?" Then, out of the blue, he launched into a tirade about how he no longer had a rickshaw driver because the man was spending all his time at my apartment and how I was ruining for everyone else by tipping him and all sorts of offenses I had no idea were offenses in which you would expect someone would have mentioned at some point to me earlier, but no one did. My guess was that he wanted to lower the boom on me, and he waited until after I'd served my usefulness. It seemed that my mistakes all had to do with being hospitable and generous. Apparently, you're not supposed to do this. You're supposed to treat the Indians as an underclass and go around like a Maharaja. I spent a lot of time among the Westerners there. By the time I was ready to go, I wanted no part of being associated with any of these clowns. I am looking for words to describe it all, but I am coming up short. I keep coming back to the term pretentious self-importance. When the Indians started congregating around me in the last days I was there, it created a heavy resentment toward me from many quarters. Things were being said about me that didn't sit well with some kind of invisible and possibly visible spiritual mafia that operates there. I felt like India was one of those places where anything could happen and often does. I felt like I needed to hot-foot it back to where I came from, and I did exactly that. Getting back was not the easiest thing I ever did, but as soon as I walked in the door of this house, I was instantly back in my usual headspace and have remained there since. For the first 5 or 6 mornings when I woke up here, I thought I was still in India, and I felt a panic rise in me that I still had to get out of there. Then I would realize I was back, and I would be flooded with relief. This happened every morning for a week. It was truly strange. I think there's a very good chance that I dodged a few bullets through that period of time, the time that I was there, that I was possibly in greater danger than I imagined because I didn't think I was in any danger. My driver thought I was, though. He kept telling me, "Bad men's want to kill you." He made sure my door was locked whenever he left, and one morning he locked me in and took the key, and I had to wait for several hours until he showed up to let me back out. A lot of things happened in India that I didn't understand. It's a stranger place than I've ever been before, and now I'm going to go I'm headed off to where I should have gone in the first place. It would be a lot simpler if I had an idea of what was going on, but I don't. Like the rest of you, I'm caught in one of those washing machine scenarios where the tide rushes in and around the rocks and then roils and tumbles you back and forth. I think the positive aspect to all of this is that if and when anyone fishes you out of there, you'll be clean. Tattered for sure, but definitely clean. I'm thinking that might well be the purpose of life. Either we are willingly stripped of all the things that magnetize us to this place, or it happens against our will. It happens either way. I've always been the sort of person who will set off straight up the mountain. I remember climbing a mountain with my friend Claudia one day in New York, and the snow was about 2 feet deep, and we just went right up the side of that mountain with our Malamute and never flagged till we got to the top. We could have taken the road and gone the extra miles, but we didn't. Alternatively to that, one can take the road. It might have taken some while longer to get to the top, but the difficulties and dangers will be far less. I remember one day driving up to Haleakala Highway to Maui. I was in Maui. I was probably headed to a small cow town of Makua, and I remember getting out of the car and looking back down the way I came and going, "My goodness, look at all the distance I came without even realizing it." And this reminds me of my friend Michael Green. He's a gifted artist who lives outside of Philadelphia in the countryside. And Michael looks like he was sculpted out of rock, and that's what he is, rock steady. While I was going straight up and straight down on occasion, Michael was traveling an unswerving course, steadily up the hill without anywhere near the dramatic turns that my journey kept taking. He found the fountain of truth and a living oracle that he was seeking in Guru Bawa, and he has never departed from his sure and certain course since. It's a little like the fable of the tortoise and the hare. Michael being the tortoise and me being the hare. I don't know how our respective states compare now. I don't usually measure myself against people that way. What I do know is that Michael had a much smoother ride of it. That's how it works for the persistent and steady among us who take the wiser and safer course up the mountain. I don't think much about risk or potential loss. Maybe I should. When I do these radio shows, I don't think about what I might say, whether it's going to be thematic or wind itself up into a tight and coherent bundle at the end. I just head straight up the mountain, and usually I have no topographical awareness of what lies ahead. So if I hit some large stone outcroppings or an unexpected valley that somehow got slashed in between the rise I was climbing and top I was expecting, I either have to skirt my way around the rocks or hump it down into the valley and then back up another rise until I get wherever it was I think I was going. I figure this kind of approach will present considerations and perspectives that might never have appeared if I'd had the whole thing mapped out in the beginning. Certainly the people who map their lives out do not find that it generally goes according to plan anyway, because it never does this. Life is an ongoing confrontation with the unexpected, which is why a loose and gentle touch proves to be the best method. One thing we know for sure is that everything we imagine ourselves to be and everything we possess will be taken from us when we leave. The only part of us that will remain are the parts of us that are real. That is all we will carry away from us with us in this life. So that is all we should concern ourselves with, being as real as we can, whether we are going straight up the mountain like me, or whether we are staying on the gradual road, being consistent and rock steady like Michael. We get there one way or the other, so long as we are steadfast and we continue. Surely, these are uncertain times, and given that, we should not be uncertain. Since we cannot see where we are going out here, but only imagine that we do, we should not be overly concerned about whether we can see where we are going in terms of the invisible, even though we cannot see or mark our progress. Sometimes it's a matter of fate. One has to trust in what one cannot see, given that all we can see is temporary and fading from our view. Well, this is a bit of a hodgepodge this evening, but best I could do, folks. I hope there's something useful in there for you. And once again, my dear friends, we have come to the end of another broadcast, and I'll see you next week if there is one. In the meantime, may you find that invisible means of support that you seek. That said, Hare Krishna, Alhamdulillah, greetings, Lord Ganesh, hail, Lord Jesus Christ, Namaste, Bahu Allah. Oh, Mami Taba, aloha, and aru!
God's not dead, he's merely hiding. You can see him in the morning when the sun is rising. God's not dead, merely hiding. You can see him in the morning when the sun is rising.
Feet to Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the OnSIC Radio Network of Stations.